So, going to the woods retreat, May 25th, 2013, Peter Williams, and the talk is titled The 10,000 Joys and Sorrows. And I'm going to really talk about working with emotional states, the ones we like and the ones we don't like, and maybe, if there's time, the ones in between. So, 2,500 years ago, Siddhartha, Buddha-to-be, sat down under a tree, a ficus, a kind of fig tree in the fig family, if anyone else is a geek like me, and he sat down under a tree and solved your problem. So how could I make such a brash, bold statement? Because he solved his problem, he solved my problem, he solved Mary's problem. He solved everybody's problem. And what is that problem? Our crux problem that no matter how well life is going, it's still slippery. The crux problem, it doesn't matter who you are, is that you base your happiness on pleasure. And that wouldn't be a problem if everything was pleasant. But we all know everything isn't pleasant. And yet, do you agree with me that that is the kind of fundamental human condition? The crux of everything is that we only think we can be happy if we're having a pleasant experience. It's the root. So I appreciate how much the Buddha, how practical he was. He wasn't interested in making a religion. He was interested in people waking up and being free from suffering, being fully awake, liberated. And so his teachings are extremely practical. They're strong enough. They're still here today because he didn't just solve his problem. He solved the human condition. And the practice has been handed down for 2,500 years. And it's a lineage of practice. And so in his practical way, he just boiled everything down to three qualities: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. No matter how famous, how rich, how successful, how good-looking, how, you know, whatever, you know, else are our cultural, you know, norms or whatever we're all wanting, it'll still be pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Massive success doesn't get you out of it. And so, as I mentioned, you know, this practice is about happiness and joy, but not L-I-T-E. You know, real, true, lasting happiness. If we want real, true, lasting peace and happiness, we have to learn to be okay with life exactly as it is. Doesn't mean we don't, you know, advocate for change and work for justice and all that kind of stuff. That's not quite what I'm talking about. I just mean basic everyday existence, just being alive in a body that feels pain, and a body that feels pleasure, and a mind that only wants pleasure. So if we want to truly be happy and peaceful, we've got to come to terms with this. This will never change, no matter what's happening in our life. It'll still be pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So even on our best day, you know, There might even be a tiny bit of neutral or unpleasant, but maybe it'll just roll off your back on a really good day. But we've all had really good days, you know, where everything came together just right, and we were just feeling so good. And then, inevitably, we have to come down from the mountaintop. And it just happens. It's just the lawfulness of life. So this is not to get morose or heavy. It's just to get real. If we really want to be happy, we got to get really real. You know, this isn't spirituality, L-I-T-E. This, as far as I'm concerned, is the real deal. This really works. But we start with the most rock bottom basic truths. And this is it. Because we only like pleasant, and there's three slices of the pie, we invoke the hindrances in our responses to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So you can guess which hindrance we evoke for the pleasant slice of pie. We want it, of course. And you can guess which hindrance we respond to the unpleasant slice of pie. We're going to leave that right on the plate. And the neutral slice of pie, we don't even know it's there. For the most part, our relationship with neutrality is ignorance. We don't notice the neutral very often. You know, we want the, like, maple syrup sweetened whipped cream on blueberries. We'll definitely take that. But then if we have to have brown rice or Tabasco, we'll probably just take the Tabasco, you know? Because even though it's really unpleasant, at least it's spice and it's something. Brown rice, like, whatever, you know? Stays right there on the plate. I don't know, there are some people who really like brown rice, so. Yeah. So, we are in a fundamental argument with reality. And this is what the Buddha meant when he talked about the First Noble Truth, that there's unsatisfactoriness in things. And the unsatisfactoriness comes from the fact that things that we like go away and things that we don't like come. And that leaves us restless in some way in our heart. That's really what the Buddha meant by the word dukkha. There's a kind of unease because we're being jostled to and fro all day long by our preferences. So we're in argument with reality. And when you argue with reality, you lose. But only 100% of the time. So if we really want to be happy and we're willing to be very kind of like sober and deep about it, we know this is what we have to do. You know, this is our task, is to somehow resolve, reconcile this human condition of being sentient. And so that's maybe the hard news, but the good news is there really is an option. And of course it's mindfulness. And you have insight into this. Anytime you have, say, just had a little itch, and you just said to yourself, oh, I'm not going to scratch that. I'm just going to notice what it's like. And you just show up for this little, like, I don't know, you know, popcorn-sized little sensation in your shoulder, and it's just kind of sitting there, and it's unpleasant. But because there's enough equanimity and relaxation in your body, you just don't get into a big reaction. And then lo and behold, all by itself, at some point, it just stops. That is a little microcosm of how this path works. We get those little lessons grow bigger and bigger and deeper and deeper. And we get it that mindfulness replaces the argument. Instead of arguing with reality, we get curious about what it's like. And we don't know we're doing it, but when we do that, we give up the struggle. And we just accept and allow and witness. And so this is the alternative. And, you know, other spiritual paths have other ways of working with this. But this is the meditative path of insight meditation and Buddha Dharma. So mindfulness is all. And kindness is also a huge part of mindfulness, as Mary has alluded to, that if we're really being mindful, we're also being kind, because we're not in reaction or tensing against. We're really accepting and even embracing the unpleasant. So I want to talk about working with emotions in this context. And so I'll talk about working with unpleasant emotions as well as working with pleasant emotions, and how we can be free in both circumstances. And if there's time, I'll go into the neutral too, because that's also important. So one of the fundamental needs that reality demands of us is to make peace with the difficult, because we all have it, maybe lots of it. And that what that usually really means is making peace with some kind of difficult emotion. Because when there's pain in the body, yeah, we need to make peace with that too. But we often make it double trouble, two arrows, you know, by all of our resistance to it. So to make peace with the unpleasant is often just means being able to really be with the difficult emotion that difficult things evoke in you. So when people are difficult, they're over there being difficult, but much closer to home is what gets evoked in you, the difficulty in you that they evoke. So think about it. If you can make peace with difficult emotions, then you can make peace with difficult people, because you can handle what they evoke in you, and then you're not in resistance to them. Then you can meet them just like where they are, without a big reaction. And so it's just immediately translatable what we can grow to make peace with inside ourselves is only going to help us, you know, better meet other people. And so other people make difficulty for us, and life circumstances make difficulty for us. And, you know, short of like our basic, you know, human needs, short of, you know, once those are met, life circumstances create difficulty in us. But mostly what they're creating is a lot of difficult states in us. So again, it's like we're working with the crux to make friends with our difficult emotions. So part of making friends with difficulty is just to reframe it, and just to get that difficulty is actually good in a lot of ways. And I don't want to sound like a Salada tea bag or something, you know. When difficulty is good, it's still difficult and we suffer. But we grow from it, we expand from it, it humbles us, it makes us more compassionate towards others. There's so many good things. We learn how to be strong, we learn how to be vulnerable. There's just so many good things that come from difficulty. It just makes us so darn human. So we're quoting a lot of Rilke. So Rilke, in Letters to a Young Poet, wrote, "And if only we arrange our life in accordance with the principle which tells us that we must always trust in the difficult, then what now appears to us as the most alien will become our most intimate and trusted experience. How could we forget those ancient myths that stand at the beginning of all races, the myths about dragons that at the last moment are transformed into princesses? Perhaps all the dragons in our lives are princesses who are only waiting to see us act, just once, with beauty and courage. Perhaps everything that frightens us is, in its deepest essence, something helpless that wants our love. Princes are very helpless too. So not to take on the 19th century sexism, but or whatever he wrote. I think that's the right time frame. And then here's something a little more contemporary, and just substitute meditator for writer. This is from the writer Colin Nissen. A writer's brain is full of little gifts, like a piñata at a birthday party. It's also full of demons, like a piñata at a birthday party in a mental hospital. The truth is, it's demons that keep a tortured writer's, meditator's, spirit alive, not Tootsie Rolls. Sure, they'll give you a tiny burst of energy, but they don't do squat for your writing. So treat your demons with the respect they deserve, and with enough prescriptions to keep you wearing pants. I like to think of difficulty sort of as like, you know, turning like poop into fertilizer, you know. It does something very, what's the word, earthy for us. You know, it makes us somehow richer and deeper and loamier, even though it sucks when it happens. But the very good news is we can actually enjoy it as it sucks. And that's through our practice of mindfulness and our practice of rain. So remember, rain is this basic, simple process of switching from being in argument with what is to being curious about what is. Switching from, I can't believe this is happening to me, to what's it like to be blah, blah, blah. And so I want to sort of throw out a few little, I really like slogans, just little tiny reminders. And we all stumble across these in our Dharma practice. We become our own Dharma coach. So I'm going to offer a few that have come to me in my practice, hoping maybe one of them might resonate with you. And then, so this is my little bumper sticker for how to put myself in wise relationship with an emotion when I'm not. And how do I know I'm not? Because I'm really suffering. But then I remember this. Accept it more, believe it less. So picture a difficult state that you've been experiencing. And just see if you can kind of apply this. Accept it more, believe it less. And I'll just, you know, I can unpack that. we don't want to argue with reality. Whatever difficult state we're in, we're in. That's the truth. And to argue with that is like, you know, to try to like slam Jack or Jacqueline back into the box when they've already popped out. You're already judging yourself, but the emotion is already here. So, you know, it's really a struggle and an argument to just to resist it and not want it. It's already here. It's already happened. And so we can accept the fact that the emotion is here. What we generally can believe less and really profit by it is our thoughts and images. You know, we spin out of a difficult state really difficult stories. And so we want to really accept, you know, that fear is here, or sadness is here, or just irritation is here. And know that our thoughts in the grip of a strong emotion are often very limited, very simplified, very black and white. And when we get out of the grip of the emotion, often we see a lot more possibilities. But in the grip of an emotion, we tend to be in brain sprain. We actually, I'll talk a little more about this, but our brain literally isn't functioning at its best. So accept it more, believe it less is kind of the umbrella slogan that I like to use for my difficulty. And so when we, that's kind of our umbrella, and the RAIN approach encompasses that. So we recognize something and we note it, and that in and of itself is helpful. And there's been studies on this, brain studies, where automatically when we activate a verbal part of our brain, it somehow lessens the charge in the more emotive part of our brain. So just to simply say, or fear, or uncertainty, or restlessness can help. So, and then the second step of acceptance is then a much bigger step for sort of helping ourselves. So right away, for instance, in something like fear, and this is true of any difficult emotion, we tend to meet our difficult emotion with more of the same. So we're scared of our fear. We can be sort of aversive towards our aversion. Ashamed of our shame. But fear is the one that's really a cycle. We don't like fear. And when fear comes, we sort of get scared of the fear. And then we're in not just fear, but we're in fear of fear. And fear of fear, of course, is still fear. Just twice as much. And just to throw a little humor in, you've probably heard the polls where, you know, what's your greatest fear? And death is something like number 4 down the list. And number 1 is public speaking. So Jerry Seinfeld has a joke about this. Is that right? Fear of speaking is number 1? Fear of public speaking is greater than the fear of death? That means at a funeral, you're better off in the coffin than giving the eulogy. So with fear, and humor always helps with fear, of course. The moment we accept our fear, we're already cutting the cycle of fear of fear. Like, oh no, not this fear. As soon as we cut that, then there's just fear. And so acceptance is a huge piece of actually settling our nervous system. We turn towards with acceptance, and we accept, and actually we can even go greater into some kind of welcome embrace even You know, that's real big acceptance. So let's just try something briefly, just a minute, to just help exercise your acceptance muscle. And so just go along with this and see what happens when you do it. What I'm going to ask you to do is to say, of course, to every single thing that you become aware of, be it a thought, be it a sensation, be it a sound, be it, you know, the thought, this is dumb, this is fake. Just say, of course. Just say, of course, to every single thing you're aware of. So we'll do it for just a minute. Okay. How'd that go? Anyone want to say anything? It was just a minute. Usually, often say 5 or 10, but just a little taste. What happened? So just for the mic, I'll repeat. So it's calming, smooths out agitation.
Simplifies.
Made
things less scary.
Made things less scary, easier to talk about them or bring them up. So a student I was working with was going through a divorce, and back when I was in Vermont, and she really took to doing some of course meditation, spending longer periods of time, and she ended up in a room. She was about to have her divorce finalized. And she was in a waiting room, and suddenly the circumstances ended up putting her and her husband there together as they're about to go and soon to be ex. And it really freaked her out. But she started saying, of course, to everything inside of her. And then the tears started streaming for her. And he picked up on it, and it just softened everything. You know, it was amazing to her just how much that little thing changed her just in that moment, just accepting her experience. So this acceptance piece is huge. It's so much a big part of this. So that's another little thing I like to say to myself, of course. You know, and if you want to sweeten the pot, of course, dear. Just like a grandparent. You know, a grandma or grandpa might, you know, they might take you in affectionately without being swept away, but being very connected as you were in some difficulty. So, and then in the investigate part of RAIN, this is where we believe our thoughts less. Because the more we sit with our thoughts, the more we watch them pinball around or get formed out of nothing. Some of you are commenting that when you're working with your imagery, just, you know, stuff gets formed out of nothing, images, you know. And we start to watch our mind do things. But our thoughts, you know, we could spend hours actually thinking about all the limits of thinking, but we don't have time, and you're probably glad. But thoughts do things like they split things, separate things. So thoughts have splitting errors. So it separates, you know, we come up with the term forest. we come up with the term tree. But that splits the tree out from the rest of the forest that it's a part of. So we can then say forest, but then you have the lumping error of just putting all those distinct trees together as one thing, and they're not. The biggest lumping error is to say it's the universe. In other words, everything, and we just call it the, like it's one thing. So our thoughts have errors in both ways, lumping and splitting errors. Our thoughts have freezing errors. We freeze things that are always changing. We call it a sit, right? Well, that's sort of lame, right? Because what was it? It was nothing but flow. It was thoughts and images and sensations and sounds just flowing like a river. And we call it a sit. And then we say it was a good sit or it was a bad sit. And then when we do that, that's another error where we cherry-pick reality and we make a little mascot. So there's some thing that happened that somehow your nervous system really latches onto, something difficult or something really good. And then we paint the whole thing with it and we make a little mascot out of it. But it was just a few moments maybe. That's another thing our thoughts do. We massively oversimplify everything. So going back to the tree is not separate from the forest, and yet it is unique. It's interdependent and distinct. And as we learned yesterday on the hike and thought about yesterday, we all knew this, but the tree is full of parts. It's not one thing. It's a bunch of parts. It's bark and inner bark and sapwood and heartwood and branches and leaves and roots and fungi that are on the roots, blah, blah, blah. The best way you could ever conceptualize anything is to call it a transitory collection. It's a temporary collection of parts, whether it's a tree or a car or you. So just put that in your little library and, you know, chew on that. Everything is a temporary collection. That's the most accurate we can be with our thoughts. But that's, so this is just talking about a thought, like tree. Then we link them together into thinking. And we learned all about thinking with that little exercise about the soccer player, right? We just embellish and add all kinds of stuff. And then we link all these thoughts with which themselves are sort of not accurate, and then we embellish them into thinking. So this is all to say, don't believe your thoughts too much. They can't be true. The best they can ever be is useful. But they can't be true because they're trying to symbolize reality. They're not reality. They're not the territory. They're the map. And maps are never reality. So we have fear, and then we have some future thought, and when we imagine something in the future, we're cherry-picking some little part of it, and that's evoking our fear. And actually, we really don't know. When we get there, it'll be just like this. It'll be space, and we'll be here in a body, and we'll be breathing, and then the situation will unfold. But when we imagine it, it's compressed, and it's 2D, and it's fear, and that's all it is, and we're just not doing very well. So believe your thoughts less. Accept the fact of your emotions more. And this goes a long way to helping you really be mindful while you're in a difficult state. So then another thing that's helpful to say to yourself is brain sprain. And by this I mean, and a lot of brain studies are showing this, when we get into a strong, difficult emotion, our brain actually is in kind of brain sprain. Our amygdala, which is sort of midbrain, it shunts our neuronal pathways away, not the pathways, but the firing of neurons away from the frontal cortex, where we're more aware and there's more sense of possibility. And we're really in black and white thoughts. And the theory is that, you know, in evolutionary time, having a lot of thoughts, you know, in the face of danger, again, was going to turn you into tiger food. Because if you were, or lion food or whatever, tiger food is probably more accurate. Tigers still kill people. But, you know, is that a male tiger starting to run towards me, or a female, or a juvenile? I wonder if it's a female. Is she in heat? Bing, blam, you know, you're dead. So apparently this little thing evolved in our brain to keep our thoughts simple when there was danger, and then to relax when we feel we're safe again. And so since there's no longer tigers chasing us, when does our amygdala usually fire? Well, for guys, it might be when our partner says, honey, we need to talk. You know, if we're not so good at emotional processing. But it fires all the time in just slight social situations that we perceive as threatening. And then we're in brain sprain. We can only think black and white thoughts. Useful when, you know, there's a tiger coming at us. It's like run or fight or climb, right? Those are useful thoughts. But when it's a social situation and it's like jerk, like, you know, we're not really at our best. We're really in brain sprain. So you might remember this. In the state of difficulty, it's actually the worst time to believe your thoughts. Because, and we all know this, right? When we calm down, we actually can have more possibilities than jerk, you know? Somebody cuts us off in traffic and that's our immediate response. But later we might think, wow, I mean, maybe they were, you know, really late for a, you know, super important job interview or whatever, you know, more possibilities. So just remember that. Brain sprain. Say that to yourself in a really difficult state. Don't believe your thoughts very much. If you're going to believe them later, you know, when you can see a lot more nuance. So another thing I say to myself in a difficult state is now is forever. And see if you're familiar with this in yourself. You're in a difficult state, and then you project out into the future, and whatever you're thinking looks really bad because you still imagine feeling this way. We actually picture ourselves, you know, in this emotion. When we actually notice our thoughts, we're doing this investigation, we start seeing, God, oh my God, I'm imagining this some future scenario, and I'm imagining feeling then the way I feel right now. I mean, sometimes maybe it's accurate, but often we're feeling really bad now. We project out, and we sort of, in our magical thinking sort of way, feel like this is forever in some way, and the world looks really bleak from that perspective. And I think the last one to share is it's not my fault. And we've already talked about this. We don't order up our difficult states generally, right? Generally, we just find ourselves in the reaction. So why blame yourselves? Why add that double dukkha, double trouble? there's sort of a whole like cottage industry of blaming yourself for every single thing that goes wrong in your life, like your thoughts are attracting everything, and everything is your fault. So here's a cartoon to that effect. This is Kaplan. Two ducks in a pond. One duck saying to the other, "Maybe you should ask yourself why you're inviting all this duck hunting into your life right now." I mean, sure, of course. I mean, I think we attract stuff, but I don't know how that really happens, or if we always do, or when we do, or this or that. It can put so much pressure on you. You know, oh my God, I can't think that, you know. And we just blame ourselves for so much. And so just say that. And I know that that might sound like you're really shirking it when some difficult state comes in to say it's not my fault. But really, it's going to include the wisdom to say, but it is my responsibility. Like, it's mine in that it's happening in me. You know, Jack's already popped out of the box, so now I got to deal with Jack. And so I'm going to take responsibility and be really mindful. But you don't have to blame yourself for Jack popping out of the box. What did it? Your habits, that's all. It's just habitual mind. So start a new habit right now. Just be mindful and drop the judging. And the non-identification piece, the last part of Rain Mary talked about, it's just getting it that if we don't order up our states, we can really get it that they're just here. And what it's none of our business that they popped out of the box, because we didn't control that. It is our business how we respond to it. But just give up all that self-blame and just realize that, yeah, this is happening right now. I can be with this. And another piece of non-identification, when you're working with an emotion and you really are in the body, say with fear, and it's tingle, tingle in the belly, but you realize that your legs, your arms, your back is not activated at all, then you see, oh, it's only a part of me that's activated. That's a great insight. There's just fear in a part of me. Fear is happening in a part of me, period. That's the more accurate thing to say. So when we do all this, so we can stay out of reaction, it means we don't feed the emotions. Instead of reacting to them and feeding them, we're being mindful. And an emotion, like everything else, is something that has a charge, and that charge loses itself over time with mindfulness. And some of you have commented on this. It's amazing. When I watch my emotions, they can just go away. Not always, but, you know, it's amazing that they do, often. And so I really like this. Dharma teacher Steve Armstrong said to me on a hard retreat where I was struggling with a lot of unworthiness, 12 years ago or something, and he said, "Peter, you don't have to change it. You only have to outlast it." And I knew exactly what he meant. He just hit me right where I live, you know, and it helped me so much. So when you're in your difficulty, just outlast it with your kind attention. When we get out of the way, things self-liberate. So what we're practicing is not interfering. Even with a difficult state, just let it rip and get mindful. And they tend to take care of themselves. I say tend because not always. But when we watch this happen more and more, we start feeling what the Tibetans call the lion's roar. And that is this, you can just feel the strength in that, right? The lion's roar, a lioness or a lion. Roar, like, I can. My mind is workable. I can handle life because I can handle my emotions. So this is a really big transformation that happens for us when we keep showing up mindfully and kindly for our emotions. Okay, so that's all the tough stuff. So now, pleasantness. Difficulty isn't enough. We need to trust the difficult, like Rilke says, but we also need to trust the easy and the loving and the happy and the relaxed. We need to not just trust these, but deepen our experience of them. And this is super important, again, from a brain perspective. The more we feel the sensations of our positive emotions, the more our reptilian brain settles down. And our fight-flight responses, our traumatic responses are stored in the reptilian brain, the brain stem. And this part of our brain, which is in contact with our automatic functions like thirst and hunger and this and that, it's also the part of our brain in contact with sensation. So we can say to ourselves after a difficult thing, it's done, it's done, it's done. But if it traumatized us in some way, the reptilian brain has gotten activated and stored a fight-flight kind of response. The reptilian brain doesn't really relate to words and images. It relates to sensation. So we need to feel the sensations of being done. We need to feel the sensations of feeling safe, the sensations of feeling happy, the sensations of being in a loving place, a relaxed place. So you are like bathing your reptilian brain, you know, in reassurance every time you're really mindful of a positive emotion. And isn't it cool that the Buddha knew all this 2,500 years ago, you know, sitting under that Bodhi tree? So we want to really be in our body, and we want to use the RAIN process with our positive states just like our difficult states. So, you know, and this is in the spirit of not fighting reality, you know. We don't want to become like people feeling like we've got to always just go for the difficult. You know, that's a tough recipe. Difficulty is not enough. So we need all the positivity we can get so we don't lose heart, so we can recharge, so we can regulate our difficult states. And it's really good for the world when we're happy. The happier we are, the more available we are. So the world needs our happiness. It's very altruistic to be happy. The world needs your passion and you following your true calling. I mean, the world needs all of you at your best. And we need to do this by deepening the pleasant states and our experiences of them. So relaxation, you know, we've been emphasizing that a lot. And in a Tibetan text, The 100,000 Songs of Milarepa, the translator writes this introduction about the Tibetan practice called Mahamudra. So this is Garma Chang, and he writes, "All pains and desires are of a tense nature, but liberation, in contrast, is another name for perfect relaxation. Dominated by long-established habits, however, average men and women find it most difficult, if not entirely impossible, to reach a state of deep relaxation. So instructions and practices are needed to enable them to attain such a state. The primary concern of Mahamudra, therefore, is to instruct the yogi on how to relax the mind and thus induce in him or her in the unfolding of his primordial mind." So just know, relaxation is just another name for enlightenment, you know? But deep, deep, deep mental relaxation, where you're no longer arguing. You're just allowing and witnessing, welcoming and witnessing. So the more we relax the body, the more the mind follows. And we get calmer, more easeful, more peaceful. So relaxation is super important part of our pleasant experience. And then what's really helpful to do in so many ways is to be deeply mindful of your pleasant experiences. So we'll enjoy them more if we're actually noticing what has happened. I mean, have you ever noticed really looking forward to a meal and then pretty much you didn't know you'd had it until you were like on your last bite? So then you kind of want more because you want to experience it. Well, if we're really mindful of our pleasantness, we're just going to have a lot more enjoyment. Meditation, rather than being the opposite, you know, going away from hedonism, you could almost say there's a way in which we can be much better hedonists because we can really enjoy pleasure by just showing up for it when it's actually there. And then we enjoy it even more than if we're not mindful, because if we're mindful, we're not so scared we're going to lose it. And if you had this experience, this happens to me a lot. When I'm eating, I'm thinking about seconds as I get to the end of my first. And there's already this tension, you know, that I'm going to lose it. So I've got to think about more. And I'm not just sitting here and relaxing and enjoying. So when we're mindful, we really enjoy pleasure more because we notice it and because we're a lot less tense about it. In some ways, for some of us, really admitting and owning and enjoying pleasant experiences can be a little scary. You know, we might have had our exuberance, our spontaneity, our joy squashed as kids. And so it can resonate with that. Or we just might be scared of, you know, the higher the climb, the bigger the fall, that if we really get happy, we're going to lose it. And that's going to really bum us out. So we don't want to really go for it. So in some ways, it's very, it can be sometimes really provocative to really go for your joy. So here's a poem to kind of illustrate the point. It's called I Confess by Alison Luderman. I stalked her in the grocery store, her crown of snowy braids held in place by a great silver clip, her erect bearing radiating tenderness. Watching the way she placed yogurt and avocados in her basket, beaming peace like the North Star. I wanted to ask, what aisle did you find your serenity in? Do you know how to be married for 50 years or how to live alone? Excuse me for interrupting, but you seem to possess some knowledge that makes the earth turn and burn on its axis. But we don't request such things from strangers these days. So I said, I love your hair. Yeah, it can be scary to be that, like, joyful and awestruck, right? And we can be very shy. I mean, that's with another person, but even with ourselves. So we want to notice that when that happens, when we hold ourselves back. Our mindfulness will help us. It'll make us more confident. Hey, I'm going to go for the joy, because it's here, and then I'll just deal with, you know, the joy ending when it ends. I'm fine. Let's go. So just do the rain. When you're in a state of peace, recognize, note peace, accept it. That won't be too hard. Investigate. Where in the body is it? You know, and don't take it personally. You didn't order it up. It just came as grace. And so just enjoy. So you can have all those similar insights with a pleasant state. And getting really specific and mindful of sensation with difficult emotion grounds you. Really mindful and specific of a pleasant state. Remember, it bathes your reptilian brain in well-being. But it really helps you be less attached. It's ironic. It's because it's like you've thoroughly spent it. So when it's done, you're done. So the more mindful you are in this, of sensation in the body in either of these circumstances, the happier you're going to be. And so then just the last thing to finish with. Because of the negativity bias in the brain, and I'll give you just, you know, another example of how that, you know, researchers know this. When you show people expressions of happy faces versus fearful faces or sad faces, that, you know, the fearful faces are recognized much more quickly by the brain. And studies in relationships show that, you know, when you have one negative interaction, it can take something like 5, you know, in this particular study, for you and your sweetie to feel like you're sort of back, you know, in a good place. So we have to make a conscious, active effort to focus on the positive as a reality need, because we're already doing the negative so well. So we need to start doing the positive well too. So gratitude is a huge piece of that, and it's a positive emotion. We can have a lot, and some of you are expressing this. You know, you just want to be saying thank you a lot to everything around you. Go for it. That's a spiritual practice. It's not just good manners. It's deep spiritual practice to thank you, thank you, thank you. And then another practice, we'll just introduce a little wee bit of it tonight, is the mudita practice, or the sympathetic joy. And in sympathetic joy, we just celebrate happiness anywhere we see it. Doesn't matter if it's in us or someone else. We can just notice it and be glad that there is happiness. A child, like at play, you know, in a park, a happy memory in our own hearts, seeing our partner happy, we can just celebrate it and, you know, say something along those lines, may you always be happy, you know. It's not about being realistic. It's about the heart's desire. We like wishing something like that. And it really resonates deeply with awakening. This is one of the practices that the Buddha said will help us awaken, is to really be on the lookout for happiness and then send it a little yay in your own way. And the Dalai Lama, about this approach, says, why not make other people's happiness your happiness? It'll increase your chances by 7 billion to 1. So cute, the Dalai Lama. Okay. So I'll just end with an image, which we probably all know. Where do you need to be in relationship to sun and rain in order to see a rainbow? Well, just picture yourself. Picture the last time you saw a rainbow. Just put yourself there. Where's the sun and where's the rain in relation to you? Sun, happiness, and radiance, and Yeah. The sun is behind you and the rain is in front. You're standing exactly in the middle. So, this is an image for equanimity, for having a balance of being mindful, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, being able to just be even, right in the middle. Yeah, if pleasant comes, you'll be with that. If unpleasant comes, you'll be with that. You can do it. You've been doing it. So, let's just sit for a moment.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.